The French director Agnès Varda was the only woman among the filmmakers of the French New Wave of the early 1960s. Over the years, she's won numerous international awards for such films as Cléo from 5 to 7, Vagabond, and The Gleaners and I, which are all available on DVD. Her latest film, an autobiographical documentary called The Beaches of Agnès, has been widely hailed as one of her finest. Our critic at large, John Power, says it provides a useful gateway to an important filmmaker's work and to thinking about our own lives.
Some filmmakers, like Orson Welles and Jean-Luc Godard, instantly announce their greatness. With others, the greatness becomes clear when you look back over their careers. Such is the case of Agnès Varda, the 81-year-old French director whose reputation just keeps growing. So does her body of work. At an age when most of us would be happy just to be breathing, she's making some of the best and most original movies of her life. Varda belongs to the astonishing era of French directors: Godard, René, Romer, Truffaut, Marker, Chabrol, Rivette, Malle, and her late husband Jacques Demy, for whom cinema was almost a religious idea. Varda has spent her whole life collecting images. It's her way of understanding the world. So it's only natural that when it came time to give us her autobiography, she'd do it on film. The movie's called The Beaches of Agnès, and it's a wonderful portrait of a full life. Smart, touching, sometimes unabashedly silly, as when Varda dresses up as a potato. She sifts through the diverse elements of her life, from her birth in Brussels in 1928, through the self-inventing moment when she changed her name from Arlette to Agnès, to her present-day status as an octogenarian grandmother and cinematic icon. Although few things could seem more narcissistic than an autobiography, Varda never slips into self-indulgence. She doesn't go all Mark Sanford in us, dishing up private details we don't really want to know. Instead, Varda teaches us how to understand our lives. We start not with our inner feelings, but with the people and places that matter to us. That's why the film brims with generous portraits of the people who matter to her. The bakers next door, filmmaker Chris Marker, even her Hollywood pal Zalman King, the softcore impresario behind the cringeful Red Shoe Diaries. She takes time to celebrate these people and many more, especially her beloved Demy, who made The Umbrellas of Cherbourg. Almost 20 years after his death, his name can still make her missed up. Looking back over the 55 years of Varda's film career, it's tempting to say that she's the most distinguished living woman filmmaker. But that would be to insult her with faint praise. She's one of the most distinguished filmmakers, period. Besides, such a gender-based designation locks her in a cinematic ghetto, the world of chick flicks and movies devoted to so-called women's issues, like abortion and raising kids, something Varda has largely tried to avoid. In 1977, she did make an overtly feminist feature, One Sings, the Other Doesn't, but frankly, it was pretty sappy. It actually said less about women's lives than the more oblique Cléo from 5 to 7, about a pop singer waiting to hear whether she has cancer, and Vagabond, the fierce tale of a young female drifter who burns too hot for our chilly world. Varda's deeply rooted feminism reveals itself mainly in her ferocious independence, in the way that she's always made the movies she's wanted to make, however personal or eccentric. As The Beaches of Agnès makes clear, Varda has a strong personality, and the result is one of the two best films currently in our theaters. It's worth noting that the other one, The Hurt Locker, a brilliant drama about bomb-defusing soldiers in Iraq, was also directed by a world-class woman filmmaker, Catherine Bigelow. She, like Varda, has followed her own interests, pointedly avoiding the female film ghetto. Among other things, nobody is better at action sequences than Bigelow. And nobody could be a better model for young filmmakers, female or male, than Varda. She began her career at 26 by daring to make a film about her hometown, even though she knew almost nothing about movies. And she's ending her career enlivened by the same youthful curiosity about the world around her. Near the beginning of The Beaches of Agnès, Varda tells us that she's, quote, playing at being an old lady. Though she's kidding, she's actually right. At 81, the playful Varda remains one of the youngest filmmakers around.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. He reviewed Agnès Varda's new film, The Beaches of Agnès. It opened in New York and L.A. and will open in select cities beginning in August. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Coming up, we'll head to the annual Barbie convention, the ladies and a few men. We're celebrating 50 years of Barbie, who, by the way, still does not look a day over 29. But first, we turn to the pages of the Washington Post magazine. That's where we look just about every week to find interesting stories about the way we live now. This week, the Post offered up its summer reading issue featuring short personal stories from four acclaimed fiction writers. We're joined now by two of those writers. With us is Elizabeth Strout. Her book of short stories, Olive Kittredge, won this year's Pulitzer Prize for Fiction. She's on the line with us now from Taos, New Mexico. Also with us is Ursula Hagee. She's the author of 11 books, including the best-selling Oprah Book Club novel, Stones from the River. She's on the line with us now from her home on Long Island. Welcome to you both. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Lovely to be here. Thank you.
As I mentioned, both of you are acclaimed for your fiction, and I wanted to ask, was it more or less challenging to write a personal story for this issue, Elizabeth?
It was more challenging for me to write the nonfiction than fiction, definitely. I was somewhat hesitant to even give it a try, but I'm glad I did.
And I want to hear more about that. Ursula, I want to ask you the same question. What about for you? More or less challenging?
Elizabeth, I totally identify with what you're saying because in fiction, for me at least, personal experience may be a catalyst, but by the time I'm finished, by the time I've done like 50 to 100 revisions, it has very much moved away from my personal experience. And in a memoir piece, there is this question too, how much am I revealing about myself?
Right. So, exactly.
Ursula, I must say your story is very poignant. I mean, you write reflections about your mother who passed away when you were young. And I love how you write about how you stumble upon the knowledge of how her absence has influenced you. You wrote, "I'd written several novels before one of my readers pointed out that every one of my books had a dead or absent mother. It stunned me, but it was true." And then you write another book where in the span of a few pages, two women die in childbirth. And you wrote, "Damn, I thought, more dead mothers. I must stop this."
Yes.
And it was funny, but so, so sad. Was it hard to live with those words as you were writing them?
Not at this point. I'm 63 now, and I lost my mother, when I was 13. I never thought of it in terms of half a century until now, but it's both. You know, it's the sadness, and also in a moment like this where you think, damn it, you know, I've been writing about dead mothers all my life. There is this, it's on this edge where drama and humor meet, and much of my writing is on that edge.
Elizabeth, your story, English Lesson, is about an experience you had when you were learning about men and dating. And I am guessing that many, many people will relate to the experience that you recount, not happily, I have to say.
Right. Yes, I
and,
think so.
But would you tell us just a little bit? Tell us a little bit about it. I'm not sure I can do it justice. I don't think I can.
Oh, so. I just had to. I think one of the problems that I had in thinking about the piece was having to revisit exactly how deeply, deeply naive I was about the world and to not make that trite because we all, of course, have our moments where we sort of burst through and understand the world's more complicated than we realized, and I certainly didn't want to be writing a kind of trite story or nonfiction piece about that. So I had to just go back and remember my summer in England when I had not learned very much about the world at all and certainly knew very little about the world of dating and came across, you know, the age-old story of not understanding what was going on. And yet, really, what surprised me as I remembered it was how I wasn't frightened. It was just a situation to deal with.
Ursula, did you read Elizabeth's story?
I did. And Elizabeth, I loved it. You let yourself become so vulnerable in the telling of it. And then there is this empowering moment where you realize, I can get out of this.
Yes.
You do that.
I'm sure there was a collective cheer went off across the Washington area as we all read through our magazines on Sunday morning. I don't want to give it all away because there is the part of the pleasure of it is realizing how you got to where you got, how you figured
right.
out what to do. So I'm not going to give all of it away. But but I wanted to ask each of you, you know, all life is narrative in some way. For those of us who have the luxury of thinking about things in that way, who have any space at all to kind of think about our lives in terms of narrative. And I did want to ask, Ursula, if part of the challenge of memoir, of writing nonfiction, is that one has to stick to the facts. And I just wondered if there's any temptation to kind of want the outcome to be different, to shape it in a way. And how do you grapple with that?
In writing this memoir piece, it was all about what actually happened. But what opened it up to me beyond that was that I'm much more interested in the impact of experience than the experience itself. And I know when I'm writing fiction and I understand what a book, for example, is about, then a lot of the material falls away. I do a lot of cutting because it just doesn't belong there anymore. When I set out to write, I never know the ending. I don't want to know it because if I already knew it, I wouldn't need to write it. And I approached the memoir piece the same way. I didn't know where it would take me. It started off with a summer in my life set on Nantucket. And within that piece was one paragraph about my mother swimming out and into the sea and taking off her swimsuit and losing it, of course. And I became much more interested in that memory than the Nantucket piece. So the Nantucket piece went, and then this became the paragraph from where everything else originated.
Hmm. Elizabeth, what about you? Do you find yourself in writing this piece wanting to burnish, tweak the story in any way?
No, I didn't. But I will say that I was struck with the similarity that one does need to be telling a story that the reader cares about. But fiction for me has always felt very freeing. I'm so deeply interested in what it feels like to be other people that I get to operate under the illusion when I'm writing fiction that I'm not really revealing that much about myself. But of course I am, and I know that I am, and yet there's this sort of membrane that I get to work behind as I write my fiction, and I love it, and I love going all over the place to different people. And so to be confined to myself and to be writing from a voice that is authentically mine in a nonfiction way felt worrisome to me. Probably it's not by chance that it was a memory from long ago, even though I remember it quite distinctly.
So now I'm going to let you go because I know each of you wants to get back to your work, but I wanted to ask, what are you reading this summer, Elizabeth?
Oh, ask Ursula and come back to me while I look for the
Okay. Ursula, what are you reading this summer? Let me put you on the spot.
I just started a book of three novellas by Josh Weil, and he writes about loneliness in an amazing way, the way I haven't seen that before. And I also just started Eva Hoffman's Appassionata.
Hmm. Elizabeth?
I'm reading A Fine Balance by Rowanton Mystery. It's about India Revolution. It's a wonderful, wonderful book.
Elizabeth Strout is the recipient of the 2009 Pulitzer Prize for Fiction for her book Olive Kittredge. She joined us from Taos, New Mexico. Ursula Hagee is the author of 11 books, including the novel Stones from the River and The Worst Thing I've Done, and she joined us from Long Island, New York. If you want to read the two stories we've just talked about, along with two others in the Post's summer reading issue, we'll have a link on our website. That's the Tell Me More page at npr.org. Ladies, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Golf's oldest championship, the British Open, is underway in Turnberry, Scotland this morning. Padraig Harrington is the two-time defending champion, but as always, the favorite is Tiger Woods, who didn't get to play in this event a year ago because of knee surgery. Commentator John Feinstein joins us now to talk about it. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Renee.
So in theory, at least, a lot of eyes should be on Harrington. What kind of shape is his game in now?
Well, not very good, to be honest, Renee. He's been like a lot of golfers who have success and decide to get better, they have to change their swing. This is a guy who won three major championships, the two British Opens you mentioned and last year's PGA, in a period of a little more than a year, and then said, I have to change my swing. And the result so far this year has been he hasn't come close to winning, although last week he went and played in his home country, Ireland, in an unofficial event and did win. So maybe he's got a little bit of confidence coming off of that into this event. But thus far this year in the major championships, he's been a complete non-factor.
And then Tiger Woods, of course, always part of the story. How would you assess his comeback since his knee surgery?
Well, for a normal human being, it's been extraordinary. He's won 3 tournaments in 9 tries. He's number 1 on the money list in the United States, and yet people are saying, well, he must be disappointed because in the Masters and the U.S. Open, he only finished tied for 6th in both. And Tiger Woods being Tiger Woods, he was disappointed with those finishes, and you can bet he's coming into the Open Championship, as they like to call it over in Great Britain, wanting desperately to make sure he doesn't go through an entire year without winning a major. He's got the chance this week and then at the PGA in a few weeks next month.
And noticeably absent from this championship is the number 2 player in the world rankings, Phil Mickelson.
Yeah, Phil Mickelson's wife, Amy, had surgery for breast cancer on July 1. She's home recovering. Phil Mickelson made it clear at the U.S. Open when he played prior to her surgery that he wasn't going to be back out on tour until his wife was completely healthy. So it's no surprise at all that he's not playing this week. And I would be very surprised if he plays at the PGA next month.
Well, let's turn for a moment to the golf course itself and how different this sort of challenge is for players as opposed to when they're playing in the U.S.
It's a completely different game, Renee, and it's so much fun to watch. This is where golf was invented, in Scotland. You don't have lush green fairways and greens where the ball stops on a dime. You have to know the bounces. The ball can go left. It can go right. There are pot bunkers that are very deep all over the course. And, of course, the wind and the weather are such key factors. As the Scots say, if it's nay wind and it's nay rain, it's nay golf.
And the fans there, John, who are they pulling for?
You know, it's very interesting to watch them go back and forth because, of course, they root for their hometown guys, a Padraig Harrington, who is from Ireland, a new young player like Rory McIlroy, who's from there too. But they love the Americans who love their game. That's why Tom Watson and Jack Nicklaus and Arnold Palmer and Tiger Woods are so popular over there. So frequently, if you get a top American dueling it out at the end with a top European, there's nothing but cheers. There are no boos. Everybody just wants to see great golf. And over there, Renee, it's like baseball. Even if you don't play golf, you know golf.
John, thanks.
Thank you, Renee.
A man who knows golf, John Feinstein's new book is, Are You Kidding Me? The Story of Rocco Mediate's Extraordinary Battle with Tiger Woods at the U.S. Open.
We are going to move now to one of the biggest stories here in the U.S., the confirmation hearings of Supreme Court nominee Sonia Sotomayor. She is, of course, President Obama's first nomination to the High Court, and she would be the first person of Latino heritage to serve there. She faces questioning from senators for a 4th straight day today, and she's still being pressed on her frequently quoted comments about how the decisions of a, quote, wise Latina would favorably compare with those of others. Many of those questioning her say they are not satisfied with the explanation she offered earlier this week, that it was a play on words that, quote, fell flat. We've been exploring different views about this issue, whether one's personal experiences should play a role on the bench. Yesterday we heard from Cruz Reynoso, the first Latino to serve on California's Supreme Court and a recipient of the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Today we hear another perspective. That's from Washington Post editorial writer Eva Rodriguez. She's a former Supreme Court reporter and a former editor of Legal Times. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Now, you wrote a piece titled Sotomayor's Unconvincing Backpedaling, and in it you wrote that the nominee's answer, quote, reeks of a nominee who's been prepped exhaustively in how to deflect possibly damaging questions. Right. Is that so wrong?
It is if you're hoping, like I am, still beyond hope, that you're going to actually, in these confirmation hearings, get some semblance of the real nominee. Of course, that's not Judge Sotomayor's goal, and it's not the White House's goal, and you can't blame them. Their goal is to get her confirmed. But as someone who has followed the court for many years and just who, as a citizen, is profoundly interested in what the court does and how it affects our lives, I would love to hear candid exchanges and in earnest between senator and nominee. And, of course, what we get too often, and both sides are to blame, is just a political game for political gain.
Well, can I put you on the spot here? Because you said her explanation came across as dodgy at best and disingenuous at worst. And from that, I take it to mean that you think she does believe that one's personal experiences should play a role.
I think it's pretty clear from reading her speeches over the last 10 to 15 years that Judge Sotomayor believes that racial, ethnic, gender identity does play a role and that it's not necessarily inappropriate. What was disappointing to me about her answers this week about the wise Latina question is that she backed off so far from that answer in a way that I found not credible. And if we're talking about politics, there's no question. You know, you bring your beliefs to the table fully and in bloom, as someone said during the hearings at some point. As a judge, you are more constrained, and you should be. And I feel that very strongly as a Hispanic woman. We want the laws to treat everyone fairly. But the fact of the matter is that there are many, many cases where there is plenty of room for judges to exercise discretion. I still don't know, from listening to her testimony over the last few days, what she means and how life experiences may or do come to bear on judicial decisions.
I want to bring up something that Judge Reynoso, Cruz Reynoso, spoke to us about yesterday. And I did ask him this question, so it's not like he just brought it up without prompting. I did ask him whether he felt that there was a double standard on this question of identity, that minorities and women are asked this question when other groups have identities and perspectives that they bring to bear, but they're never asked about that. And he said that he believes that that is the case now, that there is a double standard, as he put it, that, you know, white males are perceived to be objective until they prove otherwise, whereas with women and minorities, it's the opposite. Do you agree with that?
You know, I do think that there is a kind of double standard in the sense that if you're a woman or a minority, it goes without question that you're going to be asked how your life, how your identity has influenced you. I don't think that I would agree with the justice completely on the treatment of white males. After all, when then-Judge John Roberts was going through his confirmation hearings to become Chief Justice, there were plenty of Democrats who asked him questions about whether he could, sorry to use this word, empathize with the little guy, with minorities, with non-whites who were arrested or treated unfairly in the criminal justice system or in business or on jobs. So the assumption from those on the left when questioning Judge Roberts was, you know, you're a white guy, you're not going to understand the plight of some people. And, you know, that's not completely fair either. But the fact of the matter is that I don't recall any senator asking Judge Roberts about how his life as a white man has affected him.
Finally, is there any conclusion we can draw from the way Judge Sotomayor answered these questions in a manner that she's been very outspoken about over the years, but in this particular forum, it felt the need, in your view, to backpedal and to stay within this very narrow lane? Does that say anything about our willingness to be honest about race in this country, or is it really a reflection of what the confirmation process has become?
I think if we were talking about almost any other subject besides race or ethnicity, that we would feel much more comfortable speaking about it. Having said that, I think the confirmation process brings a particular sensitivity to this because someone's job is on the line, right? She answers incorrectly. In the eyes of some senators, they'll vote against her. So Judge Sotomayor has every incentive to play it safe and has no incentive whatsoever to sort of put herself out there on the line. I do think in the end, though, that having these confirmation hearings are helpful. You get to see your senators in action. You get to actually hear from the Supreme Court nominee and judge for yourself.
Eva Rodriguez is an editorial writer for The Washington Post. She specializes in legal affairs. She joined us from her office in Washington. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It is not your imagination. Your credit card fees and interest rates are going up. Federal legislation limiting those fees doesn't go into effect until next February. So between now and then, banks and credit card companies are raising rates on a lot of customers. John Alzheimer is tracking the changes for Credit.com. That's a consumer site. And he joins us from the studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta. Now, I understand that Citi has raised rates on some cards as high as 30%. How many other banks are doing the same thing?
Citi is one of many credit card issuers who are changing their terms of a large portion of their cardholder accounts to be a little bit more favorable to the bank and less favorable to the consumer. We've seen this really across the board with most of the top 10 and top 15 credit card issuers, you know, the guys that everybody recognizes because they're the ones that, you know, we all have their cards in our wallet.
Yeah, like Chase, Capital One, Discover.
You got it. Right. Chase, Capital One, Discover, Bank of America. I mean, pretty much anybody that's a well-known credit card issuer is going through some sort of process where they're changing the terms of our accounts in such a way that it makes it more expensive for us to have their cards.
What else are they doing besides raising interest rates?
It's the trifecta is actually what we're calling it. It's the raising of the interest rates, it's the lowering of the credit limits, and it's the raising of the minimum payment requirements. And a lot of these things are happening in concert, which actually makes it difficult for some consumers to be able to make their payments on time. And in some cases, it's pushing them into default and having an adverse effect on their credit.
So what is the explanation on the part of the companies?
That's an interesting question. The explanation that we're getting back varies depending on who we're talking to and what issuer we're talking to. We're hearing some issuers state that the economy is to blame for their changes, and we're hearing some issuers state that it's the new legislation that's coming down the road in February of 2010 that's causing them to make these changes proactively when they're still allowed to do so pretty much for any reason. We're also hearing from some issuers that are stating that their cardholder base is becoming more risky and so that they're making these changes in order to compensate for the downside risk of many of their cardholders.
Now, doesn't this kind of violate the spirit of the law in that the law says that these companies aren't allowed to raise rates exorbitantly, and they're going ahead and doing it before the law takes effect? And I imagine some people on Capitol Hill aren't too happy about that.
No, the people on Capitol Hill certainly aren't happy. Consumers certainly aren't happy. And then the watchdog groups are also certainly not happy. But you know what? With all due respect, we all expected this to happen. There's this pocket of time between when the president signed the CARD Act and when it becomes enforceable law. And that's a one-year period. And we knew that the credit card issuers were going to finish their proactive housekeeping before it actually became more difficult for them to do so. So no one likes what they're doing, but it's certainly not illegal what they're doing. Is it immoral, unethical? I mean, those are up for debate, certainly. And more consumers are finding themselves becoming the victim of some of these practices.
So what can we consumers do in the face of all this? Is there a way to avoid these high rates?
Absolutely. There are a variety of ways. I'll give you a few examples. First, vote with your wallet. Take your business elsewhere if you don't like how your credit card issuer is treating you. Second, maintain very, very strong credit reports and very, very strong credit scores, and you find yourself somewhat immune to what's going on in the credit environment right now. And last but certainly not least, be very, very selective about where you use your credit card. Be very conscientious of the fact that your issuer sees where you're shopping and sees the patterns that you're exhibiting. So avoid cash advances and avoid using your credit cards at what are referred to as questionable merchants, places like pawn shops, tire retreading stores, massage parlors, marriage counseling. Things like that are going to set off a red flag.
And you don't have to stick with the big guys. You can go with the small banks or the credit unions.
Absolutely. Credit unions are not doing these things to consumers. They didn't need a CARD Act to teach them and mandate how they treat customers properly. There are over 10,000 credit card issuers in this country, and we tend to focus just on the top 10 or 15. Take your business elsewhere if you don't like how you're being treated.
John Alzheimer is the president of consumer education at credit.com. Thanks.
It was a pleasure.
The Obama administration has withdrawn a Bush-era logging policy, calling it legally indefensible. The plan dealt with millions of acres of old-growth forest in the Pacific Northwest. Environmental organizations are celebrating. But as NPR's Martin Kosty reports, the decision is more bad news for logging towns already hurting in the recession.
Remember the spotted owl? It's still alive, not just physically, but politically, too. Back in 1994, the endangered bird prompted the controversial Northwest Forest Plan, a set of logging restrictions meant to protect the owl's native old-growth forest. Oregon's timber industry has always found the plan too restrictive, and some of the rules were loosened under the Bush administration, most notably last December, when it issued the Whopper.
The Whopper is the terrible acronym we use for Western Oregon Plan Revisions.
Kristen Boyles is a Seattle lawyer with Earth Justice, an environmental legal fund that's been fighting these moves in court.
It certainly was a whopper of a plan as far as taking out the heart of the Northwest Forest Plan and opening up these forests to the kind of old-school 1960s and 70s clear-cut logging that this region had moved away from.
Conservation groups were upset at the way the Whopper seemed to be rushed, issued just a month before the end of the Bush administration. They especially objected to the administration's decision to skip a study of the logging plan's effects on endangered species. They said the decision was legally unsound. And today, President Obama's Interior Secretary Ken Salazar agreed.
Today, we are taking action to reform the Department of Interior and clean up mistakes of the past by correcting legal shortcuts the previous administration made late in its tenure.
Salazar referred to a damning report by the Interior Department's Inspector General, which accuses a key Bush-era official of ignoring science in decisions relating to the Endangered Species Act. Conservation groups long accused the Bush administration of letting politics trump science, but even the timber industry, which wanted the looser logging rules, was worried. Ann Forrest Burns, vice president of the American Forest Resource Council, says last fall her organization actually asked a federal judge to weigh in.
We were hopeful that the agency had made the right decision, but we had actually gone to court to ask a judge whether or not they had.
Burns is sorry to see the Bush administration's logging plan upended like this because she firmly believes it would have passed muster under the Endangered Species Act. But she says she also takes the Obama administration at its word when it says it'll try to make up for some of the lost timber, and that, spotted owl or not, it does not want to see the rest of Oregon's timber industry disappear.
The mills that have survived are very efficient, very tough mills.
But those mills are hurting. Despite the housing bust, many of the mills are having trouble getting enough timber. That's because the owners of private forests are holding on to their stock in hopes of an economic recovery and higher prices. In logging towns, where unemployment is currently as high as 16%, that shortage of timber hurts. And Burns says if Oregon's mills are going to survive these tough times, they need more timber from public lands. Martin Costi, NPR News, Seattle.